Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome, everyone, to this Featured Voices podcast. I'm your host, Chris Martinson. It is November 12th, 2019. Just a little over a year ago, we talked with prize-winning author Sebastian Junger about his book, Tribe. That interview was both very popular with our listeners, as well as one that kept rattling around in my mind, especially as events have unfolded across the globe. Now, I personally wanted to have Sebastian back on the program because, first, we couldn't cover everything, but second, because I've developed a lot of questions since that interview. Now, with any luck, we'll manage to ask your remaining questions as well. But before we do, and as you are probably already aware, Sebastian Junger is the number one New York Times best-selling author of the books The Perfect Storm, which is also a great movie, Fire, A Death in Belmont, War, and the topic of today's subject, Tribe. Sebastian's an award-winning journalist, a special correspondent at ABC News, and he's covered major international news stories around the world, up close and personal. He's received both a National Magazine Award and a Peabody Award, and is a documentary filmmaker whose debut film Restrepo was nominated for an Academy Award and won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. He's a brilliantly captivating writer. All of his works, hey, they're both entertaining and thought-provoking, if not outright educational. Sebastian, welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure.
Well, the first time we had you on, look, I read your book, Tribe. And this time, I listened to the audiobook, and maybe it was that format and hearing you read it, or perhaps it was the passage of time and events, but so many new things jumped out at me. And Sebastian, right off the bat, I'm just wondering, if you were to produce a second edition, I'm not suggesting you should, but if you were to produce a second edition of Tribe, what might you include? You know, what's gelled for you since Tribe went to the publishers?
Well, you know, on book tour and just talking to people, doing presentations, one of the things I found was that unsolicited by me, I just got bombarded with stories by people that sort of confirmed that theory that that humans need community, and then when they're deprived of it, that there's a real psychological damage that can happen, and that affluence tends to undermine the need for community. And I got evidence of that from many different people, many different walks of life, over and over and over again, including a woman who had cancer and had spent some time in the hospital on a cancer ward and had survived. And many people didn't, but she survived. And she said, you know, the community on that floor was so tight that she missed being sick. Pretty extraordinary. So there are many, many things like that. And I think, if I were going to rewrite the book, I would incorporate some of those, partly just because they're incredibly moving. Moving testimonials about what it feels like to be human. I think in the political arena, you know, we've seen, you know, at the end of Tribe, I talk about the danger in partisan politics and in vilifying your political opponents. And I think we've only seen that tendency increase in America in the last few years. And I take great pains to not be political and not be partisan myself. And so I don't think I would ever identify a source for this. I don't think I would ever name any names of like sort of who was doing this, but I think I would talk about the phenomenon and how dangerous it is.
Well, indeed. And I also take a strictly nonpartisan approach, and I will both reward and cast aspersions on both sides, depending on what they're up to. And so I'm very data dependent on that. But it's clear to me that there are people who make it their livelihood to create divisions and fractions because it serves some purposes of theirs. Whether they're selling a political idea or shampoo, there's certainly a model that seems to be running that's also colliding with a really unique point of history. And you wrote about part of this where in indigenous tribes, this part really caught me because it stands out today in particular, that gross or really unfair wealth disparities just didn't exist. And if they arose, they had ways, sometimes violent, of correcting those disparities. And you wrote that Native Americans earned their status, whereas today, you know, a lot of people kind of handed it, either by luck of birth, connections, whatever the case may be. This wealth gap grows exponentially right now as a function of official policy. What sort of fire do you think the bankers and politicians are playing with here as they reward the rich and scrape at the poor?
Well, they're private citizens, and there's nothing wrong with them pursuing what they deem to be their best interests. It really is up to the government to create some guardrails so that when people pursue their personal interests, they're not eroding our national security and eroding our the political and economic and social state of the country. So, for example, when I wrote The Perfect Storm, some people were very critical of the fishermen, saying, you know, the fish stocks are depleted and these guys keep fishing and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, listen, don't blame those guys. Like, change the law. They're obeying the law. So change the law. If you're worried about fish stocks, change the law, but don't blame the fishermen that are following the law. Like, so, you know, I don't think it's wise to leave it up to an economic entity through a private corporation to sort of give up some interest for the common good. Like, they may do it, but I don't think you should rely on that. And that's where government comes in. And so I think I'm definitely not an expert, so don't take my word for it. But from what I've read, there's a very strong correlation between income disparity and all kinds of social and political ills. And that should be taken seriously by the government. And one of the jobs of the government is to protect the nation. And that doesn't just mean from, you know, protect the nation when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. It also means from all kinds of other things that can degrade our political system and our welfare. Arguably, the Russians have been attacking our democratic system, and it's up to the government to protect the nation from that, right? But likewise, if there's social and economic changes that in the long term are a threat to the integrity of the country, that is just as serious as Al-Qaeda. It's just as serious a threat to our nation as Al-Qaeda, and should be taken that way. And it's up to the government to create safeguards, even if they're unpopular with the moneyed elite, which I'm sure they would be.
I completely agree. And here's where I'm going with this line of questioning. There's this great study of primates, and they do it with capuchin monkeys, and it involves rewarding them with either grapes or cucumbers. And they have two monkeys next to each other, and they reward them equally for equal tasks. But then they depart and start rewarding one with cucumbers, which they'll eat, but they're not super excited about. And the other one unfairly gets grapes. And just watching the capuchin monkey explode with rage at the injustice, and the audience laughs when they see this, because we recognize our own sense and need for justice, that sense of fairness, in order to be a coherent social tribe, whether we're looking at that as a unit of 150 or a nation. So then, you know, jump over. Plutarch even said it 2,000 years ago, said, the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics is a gap between the rich and poor, right? So, you know, it creates some of that dynamic. Now, the question I have is, imagine, if you will, that there are central bankers who are throwing money into the stock market and driving that higher because that serves certain policy aims, but only 10% of the people in the country actually own those stocks. So they're getting grapes, and everybody else is maybe noticing that, well, in my case, my healthcare premium went up 22.5% this year on top of things from before. So what I'm detecting in myself personally, but now projecting, when I see what's happening in Hong Kong, in the yellow vests, in Peru and Chile right now, at least partially, this is people reacting to what they perceive as something unfair in the system. I'm wondering about your reflections on the role of fairness in the tribal setting and how that's maybe translating into what we're seeing today.
Well, the problem with modern society is that it's so complex. I mean, just look at the tax code. I mean, you know, a lot of people need professional accountants to do their taxes, because mm-hmm. A smart person can't even understand the tax code. So we live in a very, very complex society. So, of course, people without resources have to just sort of take the word of the authorities that they're being treated fairly, whereas people with resources can figure out how to game the system. I mean, that's true of any sort of complex system, I think. And so if you want to hire a great accountant and put your money offshore and not pay taxes, like, you can get away with that. And that's where I think you encounter this sort of awful fact that moneyed elites have a disproportionate influence on lawmakers who create laws that favor the moneyed elite, and it goes in a circle. And eventually, I mean, that's even true in this country. It's definitely true in parts of the developing world where there's systemic corruption and money just goes in a circle in the highest levels of society. And so eventually, of course, what you get is rebellion in the streets. And, you know, I think in a small scale society, A, it's not a capitalistic society. People are completely interdependent with each other for resources and food and shelter and all those other essential things. And you could spot a cheat very, very easily, or spot someone who's gaming the system very, very easily, because most human communities for most of our evolution as a species were 30, 40 people, 50 people, 100 people, whatever. I mean, the size of a platoon, you know, I mean, you can totally keep track of people's individual's actions in a group that size and make them accountable for it. And so the trick is, like, how do you run a complex society? It's so complex that nobody in it understands all the different aspects of it. I mean, you need specialists whose focus are individual tranches of the society, and they only understand those things. And how do you bring all this together and create fair policy that protects the poor and protects the middle class without encumbering individual initiative so much that it's not worth pursuing the startup company, it's not worth pursuing the invention, whatever, all that sort of great human initiative that leads to such amazing breakthroughs? If you disincentivize people from accumulating capital and serving themselves, then you erode that part of the human experience. So you got, it's very important that you have a balance. I spent time in Eastern Europe right after the Berlin Wall fell, and I'm very close to some people that grew up under communism, and that was the great flaw of communism. It was this big, supposedly ideal collective that really disincentivized people from working hard and creating outstanding things. And you know, there's a reason that, you know, the iPad was invented in America, not in Bulgaria or whatever. I mean, there are very, very clear reasons for why capitalism and the West produced these incredible inventions that have changed and often helped humanity enormously.
Yeah, I think Ray Dalio put it very well recently. He said, socialism doesn't know how to create wealth and capitalism doesn't know how to share it. And so we go between the extremes, right? If you're over on the communist extreme side of socialism, you find yourself fairly impoverished. But if you go too far to the capitalist side, you find yourself in effect at the same structure as a developing nation, all the resources concentrated in a very few tight hands. And so it feels to me like there's a moment coming up here where people are asking for a rebalancing of some kind, and it feels rooted in some basic notions of fairness that I'm starting to wonder if those aren't just, well, it's just hardwired in. It's part of our human blueprint DNA wiring instructions in some way, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think concepts of fairness are very, very important to humans and apparently to other primates, as you cited in that video. I mean, there's mm-hmm. two big threats to a human community. One threat is from outside enemies, right? So, for example, 5,000 years ago, invaders from the Eastern Steppe, the Russian Steppe, on chariots, invaded the Iberian Peninsula, and within a generation or two, killed all of the men, literally all of the men in the Iberian Peninsula, which is Spain and Portugal. The Spaniards, today's Spaniards, now have the DNA of those invading males and not of the males that were originally from the Iberian Peninsula. The females, of course, were not killed. So if you can't defend yourself against an outside group like that, you're in enormous danger. That's one great threat to the welfare of a community. The other great threat is the community splitting because of a sort of mortal conflict. And often those mortal conflicts are the result of unfairness. So the unfairness within the society can be as dangerous as an enemy outside the society. And typically, they've done a lot of genetic studies on this, liberalism and conservatism are not just political ways of thinking in modern America. Those ways of seeing the world go way, way back, and they're genetically encoded into us. So there are genetic conservatives whose primary fear is threat from the outside. Conservatives are oriented towards an outside threat in a very basic sense. Genetic liberals are oriented towards an internal threat, an abuse of power, unfairness, that kind of thing. And the genetics for these political viewpoints are divided roughly 50-50 in the population. So essentially what you have is, in any human community, you have about half the people that are worried about outside threats and half the people worried about internal problems. And it's in a kind of stasis. I mean, that you sort of need both. It's like you need both men and women in a society. And so the trick is to sort of balance those very, very legitimate concerns, but they're sort of antithetical to each other. So like the rigid sort of moral hierarchies that are good at protecting a society from an outside threat are terrible when it comes to like fairness and things like that within the society. So that's where you need government. That's where you need wise government, and you need the two opposing parties to acknowledge that each one needs the other in order to protect and run the country in a proper way.
Well, I think that's a very, very important insight. And of course, often it's presented as if this way is right, that way is wrong, and vice versa. And you had, a really wonderful story, maybe not for the miners involved, but you talked about a mine disaster where there was two types of leadership that came out that seemed to be tracking what you're telling me here. I wonder if you could recount
absolutely.
That.
Yeah. So there was a mine disaster in the 1950s. I wrote the book a few years ago.
That's close enough.
A couple of the numbers, but yeah, 1950s in Canada, in the Maritime Provinces. And so when there was a what's called a bump, like a methane gas explosion, coal dust explosion that collapsed the passageways and trapped, a couple of dozen men 2.5 miles down the shaft. And so the guys that were trapped way at the bottom, they didn't know if their egress was blocked by 50 feet of rubble or a mile of rubble. They had no way of knowing, but they could find out. They could find out by grabbing pickaxes and starting to dig, trying to dig their way out. And they dug and dug and dug. They dug for days, and they ran out of, they had almost no food, they had almost no water, and then they ran out of battery power in their lamps, and then it was complete darkness, and they had to stop. And they clearly were going to die unless people dug down to reach them and got them in time. And if you just imagine how terrifying that would be, you're in absolute darkness, entombed 2 miles down in the earth, not knowing if you're going to be saved or even if they'll even ever recover your bodies, right? And your loved ones are at the surface. And I mean, just imagine the psychological stress of that. So in the first phase, when they started digging, there were natural leaders who stepped forward who were very aggressive, very sort of implacable. Like, we're going to dig now. I don't care how you feel. I don't care if you're thirsty. I don't care if you're scared. Here's a shovel. Start digging, right? Like they were a sort of like hyper-aggressive, in some ways hyper-male, if you want to put it that way, and sort of law and order, this is how it is, you're going to follow my orders, essentially a kind of conservative viewpoint about what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work, right? And then what happened was a different kind of leader emerged when the game became one of waiting in the darkness and wrestling with your fears. A different kind of leader emerged. Those first leaders sort of dropped out. And then you got guys, it was all men down there. You got guys who were much more empathic. And they would go from person to person saying, hey, man, how you doing? You okay? You can have a little bit of my water. We're going to get out of here. All of those sort of traditionally sort of female caretaking roles were done by men, right? But it was a different form, an equally crucial form of leadership. And it was managing people's terror in the darkness. And both were necessary. They arose unbidden. These were not like people designated to be leaders. They just stepped into those roles, and they're very different kinds of leadership. And the point is, the society really needs both. And if you have only one or only the other, I mean, God forbid the Democrats run this country unimpeded by conservative concerns, or vice versa, the conservatives run this country unimpeded by liberal concerns. I mean, God forbid either of those things happen, because it would be a disaster. But you really need, like in the coal mine, like in any small human society, you need a balance of both of those outlooks to both protect the society from an outside threat and to make sure it's fair enough that there aren't fatal divisions between members of the group.
That's just fascinating. And I'm old enough to recognize now the fractal nature of this. And I think I could say the same things about any partnership, any marriage, any relationship. There, you need to have both of those pieces there. And if either one of them really dominates the other, it's not nearly as vibrant or possibly as durable as it might otherwise be.
Oh, absolutely. And I see it with my wife and I. We have a 2.5-year-old child, a daughter. And, you know, but like, we're both enlightened, sensitive people, but mm-hmm. We definitely have different approaches, and our daughter needs both. And, I'm definitely the one pushing the envelope on, she can go down the big slide at the mm-hmm. playground, no problem, right?
Yep.
And my wife is like, no, God, I don't know, that looks a little scary. And somewhere in the middle is where the child wants to be. You know, you want to push the envelope a bit, but you also want to be careful. And so you just see that over and over again in sort of classically male and female roles, that like either by itself wouldn't work that well. When you integrate them, you come down somewhere in the middle. And I should say, those classically male and female roles can be filled by people of either sex, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Out of the coal mine, it was men, right? And I'm sure if it was 24 women trapped in a coal mine, there would be, quote, male type leaders who were actually women who would emerge. I mean, I'm sure it goes both ways. But in society, often it does sort of break down by, in sort of stereotypical ways by gender.
Yeah, it feels to me like a little bit what they do in permaculture, rather than saying, is this a weed? Is it a good plant? Is it a bad plant? You ask first, what's the role of this? Evolution has given us a variety of roles that have proven enduring. And so they serve a role and have some sort of a point to them. And in tribe, you know, that humans evolved over hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. And the way that was arranged is we evolved to exist within and operate as units of a tribe. We were working, we were living, playing, we were dying side by side. And life today, I would say, is not just divergent from tribal living, but in many cases, it's directly opposite, right? It can be isolating, disconnected, meaningless, purposeless, all these things that leave people feeling a little adrift. And I think we're seeing some of that in maybe some of these protests. I'm really curious about how, you know, are there parts of society that can be reformed, or are there parts we should just really be rejecting? Maybe the smartphone or other things, wherever you would diagnose this. But I'm wondering, as you look through this lens of the tribe, are there parts of our society that really we ought to be taking a much, much closer look at and seeing if we can remedy?
Well, we live in the largest economy in the world. We're arguably the most powerful country in the world and one of the wealthiest. And we have some of the highest rates of depression and suicide and addiction of any country in the world, right? So in sort of basic human terms, we seem to be in a huge amount of psychological and maybe even spiritual distress. In material terms, we're doing incredibly well. And so you have to sort of figure out, is our material wealth actually in some ways undermining our psychological health? It's not a stupid question. And there are stresses that come with poverty as well. The one thing you lose with affluence is you lose close communal connections with other people. And the less you have, the more you need other people to make up for the shortfall. And in a poor African village, everyone is pulling their water out of the same well, you know, literally and metaphorically. And there's, you know, we mustn't romanticize poverty, of course, and there's stresses associated with that, all kinds of other ills. But it does seem to mitigate psychological harm. And so one study that I cite in my book Tribe was a sort of cross-cultural look at depression levels. And people with the highest rates of depression were, you know, urban dwellers in North America, and it was the highest income group, and the lowest levels of depression were people in rural Nigeria, the poorest. And so I look at our society and I think, okay, the Amish do not drive cars; they have very low levels of depression and suicide. The car brings great benefits, but if you really wanted to make a more cohesive communal society, you might think about getting rid of the car, right? I mean, that's not going to happen. But if you really want to have an honest conversation about solutions to this particular problem, I would say the car is a great stressor in terms of social cohesion. And the other, this is way easier to do, is the smartphone. I think the smartphone is just psychologically catastrophic for people. Mm-hmm. I don't have one. Our daughter has zero screen time. We really try not to check our email or do any of that stuff. I mean, I have email on my laptop, obviously. We really try not to do any of that stuff in front of our daughter. It works. Like, she's just not interested in screens. It's sort of miraculous. Like, we're modeling good behavior for her, and she's following it. And I think, when you see a table full of people, I mean, the misnomer of social media, I mean, it's just outright lie to call social media when it really is profoundly antisocial. Mm-hmm. To me, it's just really, really horrible. I mean, it's like the lies perpetrated by the tobacco industry in the 1970s that tobacco isn't bad for you. You know, it's on that level of deceit. And the fact, I read an article in the New York Times that the people in Silicon Valley, I mean, these are the people that engineered this stuff, right, who developed these social media tools and all the software and the hardware that support it, like, that they, in Silicon Valley, they are, many of those parents are not allowing their children screen time because they know it's so toxic. So when people say, what can we do? And I'm like, go to the nearest body of water, take your smartphone out of your pocket and see how many skips you can get out of it before it drops to the bottom of the lake forever. Like, that's what you can do to rejoin the human community on some level.
Oh, that's fantastic advice. And I can hear already in my mind some people listening, maybe myself, I hear myself going, yeah, you know, I understand how some people might have trouble with that, but not me. And that really got changed for me, though, when I was talking with somebody who worked for one of the big online game companies. So whether you're playing Candy Crush or you're doing Black Ops 2, whatever your game is, if you want to become a coder for one of those companies, one of the first things they do is they put you through dopamine boot camp. They help you understand the wiring, what's the pacing, the frequency, the amplitude of the reward structures, to create an addictive process that's no different than cocaine in terms of its actual addictiveness. And all of this is perfectly legal, and they use it, and they create massive misery. They're now camps for young boys and men in their 20s and 30s to go and figure out how to regain, like, normal stuff, like how to be humans again. It's that serious. And yet it seems to just sort of go by unnoticed that's just part of life. But I think it's great to sort of step back and go, is this really additive or is it subtractive?
Yeah, well, there's the dopamine addiction, but there's also there's anxiety. Mm-hmm. And this software is designed to promote anxiety in people. And when you're anxious, you will keep checking. I mean, anxiety, for example, is you go away on vacation, you can't get rid of the thought in your mind you left the stove on. You go back and check and make sure, right? Mm-hmm. It's a normal human protective response to a fear. If you can produce anxiety in social media, you can keep people checking their stupid phone over and over and over again. It becomes a compulsive habit, and that's what they're after, and they do it through a combination of dopamine release and producing circumstances that lead to anxiety. And so you can see, like, in the data, it's incredible. Yeah, I think, you know, when I, you know, in the 80s or whatever, one out of 10 teenagers was anxious, and now it's like 8 out of 10. I mean, I'm making these numbers up. I can't remember what they are, but I mean, it's on that order of magnitude of difference. Just like basic anxiety. And of course, anxiety leads to all kinds of other psychological ills.
Well, as well as physical ills as well, because anxiety typically comes with a cortisol response. Your adrenals are dumping, and that's like having your foot a little bit on the gas pedal on your engine all the time. And of course, your body's trying to shut all that down, so it has a foot on the brake. And anybody who's a car buff knows if you push the gas pedal and the brake together long enough, you blow something up. And oftentimes we call those autoimmune diseases, Crohn's, irritable bowels, you know, all sorts of things like that are now coincident with these people who are in that heightened state of perpetual anxiety. And this is being created, as you're mentioning, on purpose. And I understand the business case for it, but the social case can't be made in my mind. Very difficult.
Yeah. And And the thing is, you know, you're going to get a lot of resistance if the government, like, banned the smartphone. Like, that's not going to happen. And, mm-hmm. and smartphones are very good and for a lot of things, right? I mean, no one's arguing that. But, you know, I can imagine, I mean, why not start teaching children at a very young age about the dangers of smartphone use? I mean, why not? The dangers of social isolation, the dangers of lacking community in one's life. Like, you can start teaching three-year-olds about that, and they will learn it. I mean, America, you know, when I grew up, probably half the country smoked, right? And I know about smoking. Like, I've smoked off and on since I was in my 30s, right? So I know how the addiction works, and I know what's nice about it and what's awful about it. Like, I'm familiar with it, right? Mm-hmm. And now the percentage of smokers is, I don't know what it is, it's 10% of the country, maybe. So, I mean, we've really changed that as a norm, and I think we could change social media and sort of obsessive smartphone use as a norm also. I mean, maybe one day walking down the street looking at your phone will be thought of as uncool, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe one day I'll be thought of as cool because I have a flip phone. I've never not had a flip phone. Maybe my day will come. You know, I mean, you don't know, but that could change. I mean, the public perception of that kind of behavior might shift, like it does with smoking a cigarette. Yeah, you know, now even in New York City, you smoke a cigarette. You know, you're aware of people glancing at you in a somewhat critical way. Like you're it's palpable, right? And you know, maybe that will happen with smartphone use.
Oh, I love this because this is really in the myth of progress, and each new technology brings two things, pros and cons, right? I'm sure when iron was invented, that really changed a lot of things. Now that you had swords that didn't break, that enabled all sorts of things, right? This guy, you know, I'm thinking you mentioned the fishermen out east, maybe in Gloucester, right? So GPS comes along, and prior to that, these guys would sail out, what, 6-8 hours by dead reckoning, get out to the banks, drop a net and have at it, right? But now when GPS comes along, they drop the net off 6 inches to the left of where they were 2 weeks ago. And next thing you know, the fisheries are collapsing. So the argument here is to say the technology is amazing. I love GPS, wouldn't dare driving in a lot of cities without it. And yet when it was first dropped into fishing, it was amazing, allowed people to get all over the place. And the culture of fishing hadn't yet figured out how to wrestle with that technology, and it had some really bad impacts while they started to figure that out. Smartphone, same thing, right?
I mean, look, it took you know, after the invention of the machine gun, it took a generation for militaries to reorient their approach to warfare so that they weren't losing 20,000 men in a day. You know, like they had to figure that out.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned before maybe getting rid of cars is sort of a way to begin to get back towards a more tribal or let's say relational sort of existence with each other. So Sebastian, I have a really big question here because I'm currently inundated with people who are hungry to go back to community, by which I mean maybe more tribal, and I'm going to use this term carefully. It's a need-based model, right? Rather than want-based. This is a big thing we've been talking about as a group, because, you know, if I want to be good neighbors with you and you want to be good neighbors with me, that's fine. But if somehow we come into a disagreement and don't talk to each other, nothing happens, except we have a little tension. We don't talk to each other, right? So what I'd like to know is anything that you've seen in other communities or you've run across or which you would recommend or advise for people who now have this urge to nudge or if not shove themselves out of this consumer dystopian isolated model and back into a more deeply relational, if not somehow need-based model of community. How do we get started on something like that?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, like the idea of banning the car, like I was speaking very theoretically, like if there were no cars, the communities would regain some vibrancy. Mm-hmm. But I'm not suggesting we do that. I don't think it's feasible, but just as a sort of, mental experiment, I think that would probably do it. But what I find is that people have a real longing to feel like they belong to something. Mm-hmm. And they say the phrase, I'm looking, I haven't found my tribe yet, which means you're not going to, I mean, if you're looking for your tribe, your tribe is around you. I mean, like your tribe is your community, and you might say that there are people with sort of similar interests, like say you're sports fans or whatever. That's different from your community. And sometimes the word tribe and community get conflated. They're actually somewhat different things. So I think a safe way to talk about it is when you look out the window, the houses that you see and the people that you see, that's your community. Mm-hmm. And those are the people you need to connect with. Even if you might have more in common with people that live across town, just because you're part of a kite flying club or something, or whatever like that. But it's the people around you in the neighborhood that are your community. And communities are really different. And I don't know I can't give you a sort of one size fits all, like how to create bonds in a community, but you have to, I think a crisis will immediately spur sort of community commitment by people. So you have to figure out how to create that commitment without a crisis. And I don't quite know how to do that. I think it's a real problem. I think people are reluctant to do it when they don't need to. I honestly don't know what the solution is. I'm not sure there really is a very good one. And it may be that we get these incredible blessings from being in a modern society, and the cost, and we just have to pay the cost. There's going to be an elevated suicide rate. Like there's, you know, people die in highway accidents all the time, and that's what we get for being able to drive around in cars. It may be that that's just part of the cost of living in the society. And I don't know. But certainly what's within all of our control is reaching out to community members and not having a significant portion of our life occur on a screen and a smartphone in this sort of like abstract world that actually isn't real.
Yeah, you know, I lived through several experiences where power went out for extended times. One after a hurricane, I was in North Carolina, and, you know, everybody wanders out of their houses a little dazed, you know, and then next thing you know, all the freezers get emptied and barbecued before they go bad. And if I went back there 20 years later, people would still talk about, you remember Hugo in 89? Like that would be the story.
Yeah.
Because they had this enforced thing where we had to come out, we had to, you know, we have to deal with stuff. Where are we getting water? How are we feeding ourselves? Wait, I've got all this food that's about to go bad. There were things to negotiate. And that's, of course, the touch point. That all the intervening years would have been almost like a blank compared to that moment.
Right, right. And that, you know, that characterizes our evolutionary past. I mean, that way of interacting. I mean, our evolutionary past must have been one ongoing low-grade crisis for every little group of humans struggling to survive. Yeah. And so, that would be the norm, and that would be what life was that kind of community interaction. And in modern society, I mean, this is wonderful and it's awful at the same time. In modern society, people almost never are forced to rely on their neighbors in that kind of way.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is when they are forced to, usually people look back with enormous fondness and nostalgia on those difficult days.
Yeah.
It's really, really interesting.
It is. I've run across some information recently that to harken back to an earlier part of our conversation, you mentioned depression. And I've known some people, I know this woman, and her son was really struggling, and she came across him in the act of committing suicide, and all is well now. But her and a number of other stories came up that where they said, listen, there's something really odd about this, you know, the people have all investigated this as far as they can, but this depression's untreatable. And it just, you know, because usually depression is treatable, right? It's situational or it's chemical. You talk about it or you take a pill to your rebalanced and you get back to life, right? But this stuff, untreatable, that's part one. Part two is that up to 50% of people by the age of 25 now are reporting in somewhere on that spectrum, whereas before it was unheard of till you were like 40-something, right? So you have that. And then I saw this characterization where the psychologists are saying, it's not depression because it's untreatable, it's resistant. It's actually demoralization. And that happens when your cognitive map no longer aligns with reality. And that could be on a personal sense. You know, I've been fed this idea of the American dream, 2 kids, college, you know, blah, blah, blah. I pay into the system. The system pays me back. We're good. Right. And that's all breaking down. Or it could be more existential where you see the kids today going, geez, you're telling me the climate's wrecked? That's a demoralizing sort of a moment, because then what are we doing exactly? And I'm wondering how, in your experience so far and from this book, How do we cope with things like that? And what are the ways that we begin to wrestle with something as existential as thinking, hey, we might be wrecking the spaceship that we call Earth?
Well, you know, we're among the first generations of humans to faced the prospect that we might destroy the entire planet and species.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for hundreds of thousands of years, humans lived like any other species on the planet and didn't impact their environment enough to destroy themselves globally, right? And starting with the invention of nuclear weapons, it was possible for the human race to completely eradicate itself. And that kind of existential threat I don't think the human mind is sort of wired to accommodate that very comfortably. Mm-hmm. And now there's the more slow motion threat of climate change. And I don't think the species really is prepared to live with the shadow of those threats hanging over it very comfortably. And in addition, the technology that produced the ability to destroy the species or the planet is paired with a society that is so complex and alienated that people don't even have community. So not only are they facing an existential threat to the species and the planet, they're doing it without a sense of community. And the proximity of others is enormously comforting to people, even on a sinking ship, right? Even in the face of annihilation, the proximity of others, people draw incredible comfort from that. And so we have, in a weird way, we have the worst of everything, right? Even though we live in this amazing society, but that's the sort of psychological disconnect. We live in an extraordinary society, but that society is actually, for the first time in human history, might completely destroy the conditions that are necessary for life. So how do you, what do you do with that? And so as a friend of mine, a very wise friend of mine, said, we were talking about social media and all that stuff. He said, you know what, young people, their behavior isn't what's creating the coming dystopia. They might be doing that because they know the dystopia is coming and they're distracting themselves because they know what's coming. He said, you can just turn it around. And I was like, wow, you're right. Who knows which it is?
Yeah, cause or effect in this story. And as Krishnamurti said, it is no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. And that's really the punchline to this demoralization piece, because once I've introduced people to that who know somebody or are currently suffering from that aspect of things, it's actually relieving. Because instead of saying there's something wrong with you, we just can't figure out how to fix it, the story becomes there's nothing wrong with you. You're actually reading the situation perfectly accurately. Right.
Right.
And that's a complete shift of the story. And then that provides the relief. And then when they find out they're not alone, and that's the bonding that's starting to happen, because I think it's perfectly reasonable for a thoughtful, intelligent young person to gather the data, look at it and say, something's really wrong in this story. And I'm not bonding with carrying on the story as it's being handed to me. We have to do things differently. And that requires a bit of struggle on all sorts of levels. I think that's reasonable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what I've heard from vets is that when I've sort of in my book pointed out, look, you had a very close experience with some other people in a platoon, whether you're in combat or not, and you come back to America, your struggle may not have anything to do with trauma. I mean, vast majority of the U.S. military is not traumatized by things that are not in combat. It might be that you are realizing that our society is pretty darn hard to live in, actually. And you might be realizing that because you experienced the alternative for 15 months. And the idea that they don't have the problem, that society has the problem, and they're reacting in a healthy way to a problematic society. That idea was, for a lot of veterans who talked to me about it, was an incredible relief to sort of see things in that way.
Oh, fantastic. I think it's really important. And then, of course, your work here in the book Tribe begins to just open up the conversation. Let's widen the Overton window and say, can we at least talk about that? Maybe this, we don't, big foam finger number one on it. We have the best culture in the world.
Right.
No, there are things here that maybe we could improve upon. And I think for me, I don't know how to fix any of this at the systemic level, but the importance of your work is to allow individuals to begin asking the important questions, such as, what is the impact of this smartphone on my life? And do I want that? And how should I press myself maybe to spend more time engaging with my neighbors so that I can have a deeper woven set of ropes with my community around me and things like that? All things that I think my great-grandfather would just say, of course, you dummy. But these are things, right, I think we have to relearn. And so, really, thank you so much for writing the book and beginning that conversation. It's been really fruitful amongst my tribe.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And before we go, I'm just wondering, what's next on your plate? What do people have to look forward to? And what are you working on?
I've just signed a contract to write a book called Freedom. It's about, how can I say this succinctly? Only in humans can a smaller entity, a smaller person, defeat a larger person in physical combat. Only in humans can a smaller military force defeat a larger military force. A small company can defeat a larger company. There's no other species where the smaller entity can win, right? Size is a complete determinant of outcome in every other species except for humans. And what I'm writing about is the fact that that phenomenon that's unique to humans is one of the things that gives us access to freedom, political freedom, economic freedom, existential freedom.
Oh, fantastic. I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure everybody else is who's listening to this. We've been talking with Sebastian Junger and about the book Tribe. If you haven't read it, you really should. It's just fantastic. And we only covered a few of the really many wonderful things that are in that book. So get that. It's thoughtful. You'll learn something. And it's part of the conversation about what comes next. Sebastian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. My pleasure.